You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 20 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we're still basking in the glory that is the Seahawks NFC Championship victory.
We are, and before we talk about that, this is a little bit related to that, but I was hanging out earlier today with a friend of mine, Tim Bierman, who runs the Pearl Jam 10 Club. That's the Pearl Jam fan club. And the Pelton Cast came
Sorry,
up...
Sorry, excuse me. You mind picking that up? You just dropped that name over there.
I didn't drop Eddie Vedder. I don't know. So the Pelton Cast came up in our conversation.
Oh, did it?
And well, that you and I recorded a podcast came up, and I was like, maybe you should wait until next week to listen. Wait until after this one is posted. The most recent one, I may have been too excited about the game that we were just attending.
It's not your most clear-headed podcast.
I thought about it. It was a real teaching moment.
Was it?
It was a really great teaching moment for whether we should be recording podcasts immediately after winning the NFC Championship game.
I mean, I think that the lesson is you record the podcast first and then celebrate after.
We captured a lot of raw emotion.
That's true.
But it's not necessarily raw emotion that you want presented to the world.
Preserved for all of history.
So I was saying maybe wait a week or two.
I mean, I think this one should be a good listen.
Well, this is the week.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll be a little bit more clear-headed. But after we were hanging out, I went to a bar in Georgetown, the 9-Pound Hammer, and got a Lucille IPA from Georgetown Brewing Company.
That is the worst beer.
And for some reason, you hate this beer.
I'm not alone here. Like, I remember there was a group of us at Oscars a couple years ago when they had first put Lucille on tap there, and someone ordered it, and it was so awful that they refused to drink it. It does nothing for me. And it's no offense to Georgetown Brewing Company. I love mayonnaise. I mean, I think that Rogers is pretty good. They do good work, but just the Lucille IPA doesn't.
You know, it tastes a lot like mayonnaise to me. It does not taste all that different to me. And I don't really understand how you're able to taste the difference between those two beers.
I mean, it's hard for me to articulate because the experience was so negative that I haven't had it in a long time.
Is it the best IPA I've ever had? Probably not. Is it anywhere near the worst? Absolutely not. To me, it's an above-average IPA. That's why I'm really shocked you hate this beer.
I mean, first off, I don't like IPAs in general.
That's because you don't like beer.
Yes, because when I drink stout beers, that's what? I don't know.
That's what?
I don't know, but that seems more beer to me than IPAs.
IPA is the most beer of beer.
IPA is the most hipster of beers.
Oh, IPA is the most beer... Beer drinkers prefer IPAs. Yeah. 10 out of 10 beer drinkers.
Because it allows them to feel the most pretentious.
I don't know if I agree with that.
That's why it's the most hipster.
You know what I really want to do, though, and if there's any listener feedback on this, I'd be really excited about that, is at some point during, we call it the off-season, we called it that earlier,
yeah.
Which means the football off-season, even though it's the on-season for many other things.
Including the job that I do covering the NBA.
Right now, the Seahawks have encompassed so much of the world that all non-Seahawks feels like the off-season, even though the football season continues year-round.
Even Husky football seems like the off-season at this point.
But I think it would be really fun to do a podcast that is all beer taste test. If you'd be interested in this, let us know, because I think it would be an interesting thing to do.
That could be very good. I like that idea.
But to me, the Lucille IPA, you might only be able to get on draft, so it might be hard to do in podcast form to review it, but I think it's a high-quality IPA.
Well, I assume we were going to get kegs of all of these.
Yeah.
Taste test. You really got it.
That would be another podcast. But it would be a real teaching moment.
We need to start bringing in Pete Carroll for our teaching moments to really guide us.
Yeah, well, I don't think we want to touch on the Richard Sherman story. I think that our opinions are probably the same about this and some of the media backlash, and probably think that it's ridiculous.
I'm just sick, so sick of hearing about it.
I am too.
We've got nearly two more weeks of it, and
but do you have
I cannot wait for it to go away.
Any more thoughts? First off, I think it's going to go away. I think that, and I was actually thinking this earlier, that I'm really thankful that there's a two-week break between the NFC champ or the championship games and the Super Bowl, because it still feels like we're caught up in the NFC championship game right now. And it's an exciting time where we can exhaust all of the conversation about the NFC Championship game and still have a week to preview what's about to come.
So you're saying we can break the 48-hour or the 24-hour rule that's usually in effect
yes.
for celebrating a victory or mourning a loss before moving on. But here, because there's a full 2 weeks, you can take longer.
It still feels like we're caught up in it right now. You know, the conversation around town is still about, you know, it is about Richard Sherman, and it's also about that 49ers game in particular.
I mean, the fact that it's the 49ers, such a bitter rival and all of that aspect of it, I think, is a big factor in that, whereas people are going to need some time to build up animosity towards Peyton Manning.
To develop their animosity.
To really start hating the city of Omaha.
But do you have any more thoughts on that Niners game now that kind of, you know, the dust is cleared and it's a little bit farther in the rear view?
I don't know in terms of the overall that anything has really changed in my opinion.
So I had a few thoughts. Obviously, I was at the game, so I wasn't able to see the TV broadcast. And I think that just kind of sitting down and getting a chance to watch that gave me a few interesting perspectives. And then also kind of the conversation that happened after. I would say that, first off, one of the talking points that's happened after the game was that the Seahawks were lucky to win.
I've seen that in a few places. I think even Bill Barnwell started to go that direction.
Which I think is kind of a shocking perspective. And then when you look at it from Football Outsiders, Seattle was 33% in DVOA, San Francisco at 0%. So San Francisco, they say, had a little bit better offense. Seattle had a much better defense throughout the game. And special teams was the one place where there was a really big difference between the two. And I think it's something that it's not an easy talking point, but Seattle dominated the special teams in this game.
Yeah, it's a subtle distinction. It's easy to miss. But yeah, I mean, the return game was a huge factor throughout in terms of field position.
And it really was the one point where you could look at, okay, obviously Seattle was a better defensive team with the three turnovers at the end of the game, but on the whole, San Francisco played a good game defensively. But special teams was the one place where San Francisco got...
Did they play a good game defensively?
San Francisco? They didn't play a bad game by any means.
I mean, the Seahawks, in the second half, the only drive they didn't score on was this drive where they fumbled.
Well, they also were starting with a really good field position.
Yeah, but they had some serious drives in that half. They really, I mean, the first drive of the half where Marshawn Lynch just ran over San Francisco, and there wasn't a stop in that period.
There were a couple big mistakes that San Francisco made and a couple big plays that they gave up, but on the whole, I think they played a good defensive game.
You know, any minute now, Dante Whitner is going to get over to those three receivers.
They're still at negative 19% from Football Outsiders. That's not a bad defensive game by any means. And you couldn't say that in any way. They also were without Navarro Bowman for a lot of the fourth quarter.
I think he only missed one drive, and then the final play of that series.
But, so speaking of Navarro Bowman, on that play where he caused the fumble that was not reviewable for Jermaine Kearse, which, being objective, I do think that Kearse, it was a catch, and I think that Bowman...
Well, if it wasn't a catch, it was an interception.
He came down with it. And I think that Bowman intercepted or caused the fumble and came down with it. Unfortunately, his knee was destroyed in the process, and it was sad looking. And honestly, when watching the replay of it, you know, I'd seen text messages about it and seen messages about it, about how uncomfortable it was to watch, and I had to cover my eyes.
I usually don't have a problem with that sort of thing, but to me what was interesting is, you know, how badly San Francisco...
Was it like Russ Smith for Louisville?
Yeah.
you had no problem with that last year? Show me more.
I don't know. It's just
bring it on. You watch ACL tears and MCL tears every game you go to.
I do a spectacular amount. But the thing that surprised me is how banged up San Francisco ended up out of that game. Obviously, Bowman, Frank Gore broke his finger. And then Joe Staley had an injury that he ended up playing through.
And Mike Iupati also.
Yeah, Mike Iupati broke his ankle. But, so, and then in the first game here, they lost Ian Williams, their nose tackle, to a broken ankle.
That's true.
Seattle was a tough place for them to play, not only just in terms of the outcome, but they lost a lot of guys.
But on this play, right, so one of the talking points was that the Seahawks were, quote-unquote, lucky that they didn't call this a fumble, right?
Yes.
This series, which I think gets lost in the mix and people trying to complain about it, ended up with the 49ers getting better field position than if they would have called it a fumble or an interception at the one-yard line.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I was thinking at one point was that it could have been a touchback, but it wasn't. He was not in the end zone. It would have been their ball at the one.
Even then, that's a 5-yard difference. No. Because in the 4th-and-1 play where the Seahawks go for it, and there's kind of a botched handoff between Wilson and Lynch, and the ball gets fumbled backwards, the 49ers end up with the ball basically or at the 15-yard line. Everything that you get by going for it on 4th-and-1 was almost completely negated for the Seahawks defense there.
Absolutely. That's something we talked about on the podcast after the game.
So
the one place where they were a little lucky, where it could have actually even been a worse scenario, was if San Francisco had been able to scoop and score there.
But saying that luck caused the 49ers not to win this game was a really strange conversation that came out of the post-game press because of that play.
I don't think there was that much of it, but I think part of it was the recency effect, whereas San Francisco's fumble luck came mostly early in the game, and Seattle had it late in the game.
It's true. And then, so, the other thing that I noticed, so I was watching the NFL Network, like, fast replay of the game.
Condensed Fox broadcast.
And there was a play, this was on the last drive when the 49ers were driving, and Kaepernick at some point in the second half had started deciding that against the Seahawks zone, he was going to lob the ball over the Seahawks defenders, right? And so he threw one such pass, which was a completion, I believe, to Michael Crabtree, and it went over Walter Thurman's head, and Joe Buck and Troy Aikman kept calling him Earl Thomas, and they were like criticizing Earl Thomas for not making this play over and over and over again, and it was really clearly Walter Thurman.
You know, heat of the moment.
It was a strange thing, and they kept showing replays of it. I'm watching it there, and like, is nobody else seeing what's going on? At no point, I thought it was, because it was Troy Aikman who first pointed out, and I thought at some point Joe Buck would come in and say, that's actually Walter Thurman, not Earl Thomas, but nothing.
Well, it didn't end up mattering.
I mean, obviously, nothing that the announcers say matters, I suppose.
But that play didn't end up mattering.
I agree that it didn't end up mattering. But also, just can't reinforce enough that the 3 turnovers that Cap had in those last 3 possessions and about how great the Seahawks defense was in this game and how it'll be really interesting to see them against the Broncos. Obviously, no threat of Peyton Manning scrambling up the middle on broken down plays.
No, safe to say. But also probably not the same kind of mistakes that Kaepernick is prone to occasionally making.
Absolutely not.
You know, I think one of the things that I was really disappointed the way that all the Sherman conversation has overshadowed the X's and O's of what happened in the game. And there's been some great stuff about that. Danny Kelly of Field Goals writing on SB Nation had a good breakdown of the final play to Crabtree and, you know, how Richard Sherman was able to set up that interception. And then there's also, I can't remember where I saw it now, but a very good reported breakdown of the touchdown to Jermaine Kearse and how, you know, we kind of thought that was the play call, but it turns out that's a read based on the fact that they saw there was a false start. Everyone goes deep in that scenario, take advantage of the free play.
Interesting. That's really interesting. And a great play by the Seahawks. I suppose another one of the conversations is that I heard a lot of talk about in this kind of plays in that scenario that Russell Wilson didn't have that good of a game. You hear this also?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he didn't. He fumbled multiple times, potentially, depending on who you assess the credit or blame on, you know, some of those botched snaps / handoffs. And his scrambling, he made a lot of mistakes in that regard.
When watching the replay of the game, and again, I started watching it in the second half, so I kind of missed the bad parts of it. But what Russell Wilson was doing in the second half was making perfect throws in a lot of situations, even passes that weren't completed. I thought he had a brilliant game in that second half against a really good defense.
I thought his passing was on point. It was what we expect in that regard. It was more early season Russell Wilson, which fumbles have been consistently an issue for him, and he does have a tendency to take a lot of sacks because of his scrambling.
So let's move past this game, right? That's it. We're putting a bow on the Seahawks versus the 49ers. We lead the season series, or the overall series, 16-15. We don't have to think about Jim Harbaugh again until next September.
Can we think about him watching the Super Bowl from home?
That would be really cool. I would like to. Let's think about that.
Okay.
While we're watching the Super Bowl, let's think about Jim Harbaugh watching the Super Bowl.
He gets really angry about calls while watching the game at home.
I'm sure he does.
He was asked in his postseason wrap-up press conference whether he would be rooting for the Seahawks, and he said he would be rooting for, pulling for whoever, like, played harder and executed better in the day. Which is a very strange, but very coaching.
Who he's cheering for will change throughout the day. It's a complicated answer, and also it's being judged through the mind of Jim Harbaugh.
But one of the things that both coaches also talked about was how this rivalry brought out the best in each other and their teams, and there was a very nice moment between them on the field after the game, really showing how you can put aside the feelings of rivalry and appreciate your opponent.
So I've learned something. You want to talk about Win Forever?
Let's please talk about Win Forever.
I learned something. So last week on this podcast, we had a conversation about how I felt that it was appropriate to hate your opponents, but also respect them.
And our friend Damon Agnos, a loyal listener of the program.
And before you get into that, I was saying that I felt this was the perspective, and we're always trying to live up to the Win Forever mentality. And I felt like within the Win Forever perspective, that that was the right perspective.
And it's not. He found a passage that specifically dealt with this in Win Forever, where Pete Carroll says that initially, you know, he had a tough time getting past this, but eventually he realized that the opponent is not his enemy, and that the opponent is who gets you to work harder and allows you to be at your competitive best, which is obviously a big Pete Carroll thing. And from that, the extreme perspective, he says, then, is to love your opponent and not to hate them.
And you win that argument.
I do.
You win that argument within the Win Forever vacuum.
Which is the vacuum in which we're operating, the Pete Carroll vacuum.
You might not win that argument in every situation, but if you're judging it from the Win Forever vacuum, you win. I'm not going to dispute that. And it was something that we were talking about while we were tailgating before the game, about 49ers fans who are around us. We don't hate those 49ers fans. They allow us, we love them for allowing us to be the loudest Seahawks fans we can be. I really learned, it was a great teaching moment. I learned from Pete Carroll that we don't hate the 49ers. We love the 49ers. And we love the fact that we got to play the 49ers and that they allowed us to be the loudest CenturyLink field has ever been.
I mean, how awesome, knowing you're going to win, how awesome is it to have won against the 49ers as opposed to against a lesser foe?
I mean, it probably would have been great no matter what.
Yeah, it's not going to be bad either way. But it was better because...
But in this weird perspective, I love the 49ers more than I love the Carolina Panthers because playing...
Man, it's hard. I love the Panthers so much.
Playing against the 49ers and elevating ourselves to the level of cheering against the 49ers brings us to such a Win Forever perspective.
Absolutely. How important do you think the Win Forever perspective is to the Seahawks' success?
I think it is a really important perspective. I think that value the football is something that the Seahawks really try to do. There actually are really some times where Russell Wilson doesn't. He values the football when he's passing the ball. Sometimes when he's being hit, he doesn't value the football as much as Win Forever would like.
It's true, but I think valuing the football explains some of the conservative play calls that gets everybody all up in arms.
It's true. But it also explains this game, the Seahawks were playing a particular defense that was going to take advantage. We're talking about the 49ers again, despite the fact of the bow and things like that. They were playing a particular brand of defense that was going to take advantage of Colin Kaepernick's ability to make mistakes.
Yep.
And they value the football, and they value taking the football away because they value the football.
Yep.
So they were willing to give up a few passes that sailed over their heads, but they knew at some point that Colin Kaepernick would make passes that they would intercept. And they did it twice out of the last three possessions.
I think it's a winning philosophy. I think a couple things. Number one, I think it's interesting that Pete Carroll is really hung up on the forever. Like, there was a game earlier this season where there was a clip from the locker room, and he was talking about, this is the way we're going to play forever. And I think that Pete Carroll may actually believe he's immortal.
Do you not want to play like that forever? That's an interesting thing, though, is Pete Carroll is not just saying, this is my philosophy right now. I don't fit in with the sands of time. This is a philosophy that makes sense when football was invented. This is a philosophy that makes sense in the 1950s. This is a philosophy that makes sense post-merger. And this is a philosophy that makes sense in future robot football.
I hadn't even considered that.
You're not just winning right now. You're winning forever.
And I think if you're interested in the philosophical implications of Win Forever, Damon has put together a very nice ebook that he was gracious enough to share with us that goes into some of this in great detail.
And I think we really believe that Win Forever is not just a philosophy to winning a football game or to, I don't want to say winning in life because that conjures Charlie Sheen, but to making yourself the best possible person you can be on a day-to-day basis. But Win Forever is almost a religion of sorts.
That's not unfair.
We're all children of Win Forever.
There's a belief system there.
There is.
Without question.
Somehow your religion involves valuing the football. It's all about the ball. That's the thing. Always be competing, right?
Yeah.
It's not something that only is relevant within the context of a football game or a sporting event. You should always be competing in every single thing you do.
I think that's something we've always felt. And it's sometimes gotten us in trouble with people outside our family who don't understand that always compete philosophy.
It's an interesting thing where I think about it to my philosophy with fashion.
You have a philosophy with fashion?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Which is, fashion, and this is always be competing, think about it. Fashion should not just be something that you're concerned with when you're going out or when you're going to here or there or to meet this person or that person. Fashion should permeate throughout your entire life. If you're interested in fashion, every single thing you do should be fashionable.
Okay, well, I'm clearly not interested in fashion then.
Clearly. Do you see your husky hoodie? Your sweatpants? Your track pants?
Well, we're recording a podcast. There's not really a strong visual element.
But when you go home, you don't change into sweatpants. You change into the nicest possible looking comfort wear you can wear.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
You have to always be competing.
I think going back to this, though, the other aspect of it is that Pete Carroll's philosophy and it's even though it's about Win Forever, it's about more than wins and losses in a strange sense. Mm-hmm. And I think that's allowed the Seahawks to play at an even keel all season long. They've been thinking championships since day one, but at the same time, paradoxically, not allowing themselves ever to get ahead of their task. And I think that was crucial in staying on a level throughout the season all the way up through the championship game. And
now, is there a Win Forever tenet that you think applies to that?
There probably is. I'd have to look up the pyramid.
The pyramid, the triangle.
I mean, yeah, there's nothing inherently pyramid about it, as David has noted.
In the meantime, while you look that up, can I tell a story from an NFL Network program that I saw about Pete Carroll yesterday?
Of course.
So there was a show called Sound Effects of Pete Carroll, and he was mic'd up at a few different events, and they just were showing Pete Carroll various times yelling at his players and being fired up, and quotes from Pete Carroll. And so they showed one time, this was when he was, and it was back to when he was coach of the Patriots. They had no footage when he was coach of the Jets, unfortunately, or USC. This was just in the NFL. But there was a time where Devin Hester was talking to Pete Carroll on the sideline of a Bears-Seahawks game from a few years ago. And Devin Hester was like, "Why didn't you recruit me when I was going to college?" And Pete Carroll was like, "I don't know, we didn't know about you." He was like, "We never blanketed an area, so we never like paid attention to every single guy." And Devin Hester was like, "I was the number one cornerback / running back coming out of high school." And Pete Carroll's laughing. And it's true, and I looked it up on Scout. Number 3 overall prospect coming out of high school. Pete Carroll admitted to not knowing who he was, but then this is the best part of the whole story. Pete Carroll, he was like, "Where are you from again?" Which is hilarious that Pete Carroll didn't know that. Devin Hester's like, "I'm from Florida." He's like, "Oh, that's Lane Kiffin's area." He was like, "You should blame Lane for the fact that you didn't go to USC."
All right, we'll go back to this. I think practice is everything. is probably the closest. But there's not maybe necessarily a specific thing. But I think the other thing about it is Picot's been preaching this whole philosophy since he arrived here in 2010. And there's a chance, you know, after the 2011 season, when you have 2 7-9 years, granted one of them turning into a trip to the playoffs and a playoff win, that it sounds kind of silly to be talking about win forever. But I feel like even those first two seasons, from the start, there was always building a foundation for what has happened here.
Absolutely. And the other thing about how practice is everything applies to the fact that they stayed steady throughout the whole season. It's not winning is everything, right?
No.
Or losing is everything.
You only win forever by doing all these other little things on the way to doing it.
Win forever is just the peak of what you do. They're saying all of these other things amount to win forever.
Absolutely.
So if you go into a game against the Colts, right, and you somehow lose to the Colts, but you practice really hard that week, because practice is everything, and you competed as hard as you could throughout that week, because you have to always be competing, then you're still winning forever, even though you lost that game.
I would agree with that, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, speaking of, do you have any more on Win Forever?
I think that covers it.
Speaking of transforming the team when he came here, I want to talk a little bit about, since this is the bye week before the Super Bowl, right? I want to talk about how this Seahawks team was made.
I think it's kind of stepping back and taking we've had kind of the micro view for a long period of time here where we're talking about specific matchups and the X's and O's, but let's talk about the macro and how this team was built.
That's interesting that you're saying the macro, because I want to pinpoint one day.
Oh, okay.
And to me, and maybe you have a different, do you have a specific day or a general time period?
I have a specific point in a game.
Oh, okay. To me, the time that this current Seahawks team was made, the team that's going to the Super Bowl, and the most important point in current Seahawks history, April 22nd, 2010.
I'm assuming that was the day of the NFL draft.
That was Pete Carroll and John Schneider's first NFL draft. Pete Carroll was hired in January, which obviously is an important day in Seahawks history. That's too obvious, right?
Yeah.
Saying those two coming aboard. But so it was the first year that the NFL draft was held in the current format of Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, right?
Uh-huh.
And it was an interesting thing. I was a season ticket holder for the first time, I believe, in the Jim Morris season that preceded this year, right?
Which was not real fun.
It was a horrible year.
Especially for Lindo Mare.
And it was hard to be a Seahawks fan after that. You know, it was a fun atmosphere going to the games. But it was not... Honestly, the team felt hopeless. It was like, okay, you've got an old man quarterback. You've got no running game. You've got nothing going for you at all. Maybe Aaron Curry will develop into a good player. Right? That really was the climate of the team.
Oh, Aaron Curry.
And can you remind me how we got the second draft pick?
The second first-round pick was thanks to the Denver Broncos trading up to take a cornerback named Alphonso Smith in the second round of the 2009 draft. So they traded a second-round pick for a first-round pick, which is interesting in that now the Seahawks are playing the Broncos.
Did you know that off the top of your head?
You
looked that up earlier.
No, I did not. It came up so much in Football Outsiders because it was like their ultimate example of a stupid trade. Obviously for the Broncos side of it, not for the Seahawks side of it. So tell us, who did that pick turn into?
So well, no, April 22nd, 2010, right? Seahawks have two first-round draft picks, and they are with the first pick, and this was the Seahawks pick, I believe.
Yes.
Pick 6, Russell Okung. The second pick in the first round, pick 14 for the Broncos, Earl Thomas.
That was a pretty good pick. That was a good trade. He's had a better career than Alphonso Smith. Is Alphonso still even on the team?
We'll see in a couple weeks. This moment, and I really think...
He's not in the NFL currently.
This moment, though, I think is what really defines this current Seahawks team. And you look at it and you say, okay, they drafted the big left tackle, right?
Yeah.
So they're going to be committed to the run game. All of the success that they've had after that, and all the success that Marshawn Lynch has had, and drafting all these other running backs, and filling out the rest of the offensive line, has been because of having this anchoring offensive lineman in Russell Okung. They're saying, we are going to be a running team, right?
Yeah.
And then with your next pick, you come out and you draft Earl Thomas, and you say that our defense is not going to be built from the line going back, right? which a lot of teams try to build that way. Some, a team like the Panthers, probably a team like the 49ers, maybe they build from their linebackers, but they're saying, we are going to build from our secondary, which is where the Seahawks are the best team in NFL history, right?
Without question, LOB.
And what does LOB mean? Oh, the Legion of Boom. People were saying LOB a lot, like that's left me. On base.
That's how Sherman ended the interview.
Oh, I didn't. I've only seen it like one time. I try not to pay attention to it because of the uncomfortable comments after. But so they're saying that we are going to build as a secondary team and a running team, right?
Yeah.
Pete Carroll is a secondary guy. He played at the University of the Pacific.
That's nice that you got the Pacific in there.
He played defensive back.
He did.
Pete Carroll is a defensive back coach. And in this moment, he decided, there's a third factor, which I didn't write down earlier, but also, it showed that Pete Carroll was breaking from his college. He didn't draft Taylor Mays when he drafted
him. A lot of people here wanted him. O'Day product, Taylor Mays.
He didn't draft the local guy, and he didn't draft the player he coached at USC.
That was a good decision.
He drafted who he thought was the best player for the team, and something that would continue throughout, I say that as if it's over, but that has continued throughout John Schneider and Pete Carroll's tenure here, that their personal relationships do not matter. They just want the best player.
Well, you left out one thing, which is they also drafted a 5'9" free safety. Which is not that crazy in safety terms, but Earl Thomas is still undersized, breaks that mold a little bit, and they have obviously been unafraid to do that kind of thing throughout their tenure. But as a Seahawks fan, what it reminded me of was draft day 1997,
yep.
When they traded up to get Walter Jones and Sean Springs.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Hutch and Alexander.
No, that I believe that was 2000.
But I guess when you think about it, three times the Seahawks have had two first round picks.
Yeah, it's a good thing to do.
They have hit every single one of those picks.
I think Alexander might actually have been with Chris McIntosh. Was he with?
Oh, was that with McIntosh and not Steve?
I think he might have been McIntosh. Wow. But anyway, it was the same kind of thing where you got two foundational players on the same day, and that was also a turning point in franchise history because it was the day that Paul Allen announced that he had taken out an option to purchase the team and put in the money for those signing bonuses, and eventually, obviously, you get the vote where they agree to build what has become CenturyLink Field. Allen buys the team, and that is a transformative moment in franchise history.
Probably looking back a little bit farther.
But if I'm to pinpoint a moment where this team took...
But I want to talk about the personal aspect of that also.
Okay.
So, on this day, I was so, and this is a fun thing that I was going to go to, but I was so jaded about the Seahawks at the time, and I'm not saying I'm a bandwagon fan because I had season tickets the year before, but, and I was really excited about Pete Carroll, right? But I was so jaded about the team that I didn't really pay attention to that draft. And you hate the NFL draft, or at least hated the NFL draft.
I do.
So I kept hearing from you about how horrible the NFL draft was.
Yes.
I really thought they drafted Hutchinson and Alexander in the same year.
Nope.
So it was Sean Alexander and Chris McIntosh, so they didn't hit on all of those.
Well, McIntosh would have had a nice career if he hadn't had injuries.
But there was a Sub Pop 25th anniversary party, maybe 20th anniversary party, at the Admiral Theater in West Seattle that same night that the Seahawks drafted Earl Thomas and Russell Okung. And so I was kind of paying attention on my computer to the draft, and ended up going to that, and the band Avi Buffalo played.
Well, there you go.
Who at the time I thought had a really bright future. I thought they would be a huge group. And I distinctly remember eating the Sub Pop cake and having a really good time at the Admiral Theater. And then also kind of in the back of my mind noting that the Seahawks had this draft day. And it turned out that that was the day that led to, in my opinion, everything that has come for the Seahawks.
So part of the reason I hate the draft is because it always comes up against the start of the NBA playoffs, and that night I was in Portland watching the Blazers lose to the Phoenix Suns in Game 3 of their series.
Interesting.
So, anyways, my moment that I would pinpoint, really, is the fourth quarter of the game at Chicago last season. So, at that point...
They did have two first-round picks. Sorry, I have to interrupt you again. Steve Hutchinson and Corin Robinson.
Oh, K-Rob, yes, of course.
I knew that Hutchinson was one of two first-round picks. Anyway, go on.
So last season at Chicago, the Seahawks are trailing in that game against a very good Bears team that at that point they're 6-5, looking at potentially going to 6-6 and needing to win all of their last four games to have any shot at the playoffs including at Buffalo and hosting San Francisco. And it's kind of the season is teetering a little bit. And they're down, and they have no choice but to put their trust in Russell Wilson. And time again, Russell Wilson delivered in that game with huge runs and huge throws, and the Seahawks come back to win in overtime, 23-17. It ends up being the start of a 5-game winning streak to end the regular season, plus the first game and the playoffs. And I think it's really it accelerated the timetable. I think that the pieces were already in place at that point because obviously Pete Carroll had built the defense. The running game was there with Marshawn Lynch at the end of the 2011 season. But you needed a quarterback to really allow you to play among the elite and to be at a point where you could be competing for a Super Bowl this year. And that's what happened after the reins were really taken off Russell Wilson at that point. He was trusted and allowed to go out and be himself and make plays. And the result is that since that moment, the Seahawks are doing some math off of the top of my head here. I believe 21-4.
Good. They're good.
Very good.
Since then. If you can look this up, the record, you may have tweeted this, the Denver Broncos and the Seattle Seahawks combined records since legalizing marijuana.
Since legalizing marijuana. So that happened, it was actually the week before that Chicago game. I'm pretty sure.
But I do agree with you. Basically what you're saying is that Russell Wilson is the transformative piece to the team.
Absolutely. He's what turns you from a very good team to an elite team.
And that moment when he became Russell Wilson, when he was more actualized as a quarterback, was the moment that the Seahawks were transformed.
The other thing I'd note is actually the Fail Mary play, the simultaneous possession against Green Bay. Because without that, you could potentially fall to 1-3 after losing at St. Louis the next week. And the pressure to replace Russell Wilson with Matt Flynn might have gotten pretty strong. And obviously, I don't even want to think about how different franchise history is at that point.
So you also want to give the refs credit for it, too.
I want to give Golden Tate credit.
Honestly, a lot of things. And also, Golden Tate drafted in that same draft with Russell Okung and Earl Thomas. And then you look at it, and you see Cam Chancellor in the 5th round. So you basically pick up the 2 safeties that year for the Legion of Boom. And then the following year, you pick up the 2 corners, if you're counting Byron Maxwell, in the 5th round and the 6th round after that. But year after year, when you look at these drafts that John Schneider and Pete Carroll have had, they're impressive, you know?
The other thing I want to look up, and maybe we'll talk about this next week on the podcast, is how remarkable it is that the Seahawks are going to 2 Super Bowls within a decade span, and there is literally, other than the owner, no connection between the 2 teams. Entirely different coaching staff, no players in common whatsoever. Like, if the Patriots had gone to the Super Bowl this year, they'd have more connection with that team that won the Super Bowl in 2002, mm-hmm. 12 years earlier, than this Seahawks team does.
The Patriots are the one team, where I was listening to Bill Simmons earlier today, just recounting all of these playoff appearances, which also, I mean, like, nobody's going to feel sympathy for you for losing. He's like, well, you know, in all of the times that they lost in the playoffs, they haven't scored more than 17 points. It's like, okay, you've been to the playoffs every single year.
But it's remarkable to be able to go through an entire that team peaking and then declining and then this new team coming up and to be able to get to a Super Bowl again within that short a period of time.
I absolutely agree with you. And you look at the team that they played, a team in Pittsburgh who, for all intents and purposes, still looks fairly similar. You know, they still have the same quarterback. Mike Tomlin wasn't the coach then, but was coming in very soon thereafter. And kind of the whole climate of Pittsburgh is really similar. The Seahawks are a completely different climate than they were then.
Absolutely.
So, anything else on team building? I mean, we can talk about this all day. The drafts are really the one portion where you look at it and you're like, all right, they got him in the 5th round, him in the 6th round. And when you look at it before then, you're like, oh my God, wow, what the 2008 draft.
It almost makes me feel like the Seahawks should trade back over and over again and just get like 10 5th-round picks, and one of them is going to turn out to be a superstar.
They ended up getting some okay players in these early drafts. In 2007, they drafted Brandon Mebane in the 3rd round. In 2008, they drafted Red Bryan in the 4th round. But they also drafted Lawrence Jackson, John Carlson, Owen Schmidt, a person named Tyler Schmidt, whose position is listed as long snapper.
Justin Forsett was a nice separate.
Justin Forsett and a kicker. It's just like, okay, no pro bowlers. Look how far we're looking back. 2006, 7, and 8.
Well, the old regime did get Max Unger in the second round in 2009.
And then you come along, and the Pete Carroll, John Schneider regime is getting some of the best players in the NFL deep in the draft.
Absolutely.
So that transformation is pretty huge and pretty insane.
And that's where John Schneider needs a lot of credit. We talk a lot about Pete Carroll on the podcast, obviously, but John Schneider, from a personal perspective, just as important. I mean, I don't know if he'll win it because it usually goes to teams that turn it around.
Unfortunately, the Seahawks were too good last year, but not good enough for them to win a lot of awards, where Pete Carroll probably is not going to win Coach of the Year. It'll probably go to somebody like Ron Rivera, somebody like that.
Yeah, or Andy Reid.
Or Bruce Arians, Andy Reid. Executive of the Year may go to a team that turns it around, or may go to somebody like John Elway for this year. They're in this complicated situation where they're not going to win these awards. But also, we're hoping that they win an extreme award.
Yeah, that's the real
No, an award that does not matter anywhere, or matters a lot more than Executive of the Year.
For certain.
But let's wrap things up by talking about basketball. Because that's still happening.
So, well, the Seahawks were beating a team from the Bay. The Bay Area was getting some tiny measure of revenge by...
I think they would have traded.
I think so, too. By destroying the Huskies. A 26-point loss at Cal on Wednesday, and then a more competitive game at Stanford, but another loss on Saturday night to go 0-2 and drop to 3-3 in Pac-12 play.
I didn't see either of the games. I had other things going on, apparently. Maybe I forgot that those games were happening. Maybe I think they were canceled.
I think the common thread really was a lack of outside shooting, especially when teams are able to load up now on CJ Wilcox. He's not getting almost any help. The rest of the team is shooting around 17% from three-point range in conference play. So that's obviously not going to get it done.
Is there something on the horizon that you're excited about?
I mean, you know, I think that that's going to regress to the mean a little bit. We saw the defense, in terms of three-point defense, really regress to the mean last week, and hopefully that's all the regression we're going to see. But, you know, the schedule even gets a little easier the next few weeks. They've played four of their first six on the road. Now you've got Oregon and Oregon State at home this weekend. Oregon really struggling after a great start to the season, a chance to potentially pull that upset. Oregon State's coming on a little bit, but still a team you feel like you should be able to beat at home, and then at Wazoo next week. So, you know, there's an opportunity there to go on a little bit of a run.
At Wazoo?
Yeah.
There's a chance of winning three in a row.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a great chance.
What do you think beating Oregon would mean?
I mean, it's not as much as when they were off to a great start, but A, it's always Oregon, and
to me, the only goal was the NCAA tournament. Nothing else matters.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be really tough to do at this point. You have to...
At large.
You'd have to finish in the top four of the conference, at least, and this team just isn't that talented, I don't think. So you kind of need to get these next three games, because after that, then you have at Utah, at Colorado, which is a tough back-to-back, especially with the altitude. And then Stanford and Cal come to town. And right now, those are two of the teams that are maybe playing as well as anyone in the conference. So,
what do you think about chances of winning, let's say, 1 or 0-1 or both of these games against the Oregons?
I would say maybe a 25% chance of winning 0. Maybe 20%, maybe a little bit less than that, because that would be 50-50 both games. So I'd say, like, you know, maybe a 20% chance of winning 0, 50% of winning 1, and that would leave 30% chance of winning 2. So I think a slightly better chance of a sweep than getting shut out.
Really?
Yeah.
That'd be exciting. And they play Oregon first? Is that on Wednesday or Thursday?
It's Thursday night, 8 p.m., so that'll be a big one. And then Saturday afternoon, 2 p.m., Oregon State.
It's nice to not have football to pay attention to, aside from the Pro Bowl.
Which you don't have to pay too much attention to.
Oh, I'm going
to
pay attention to that.
But another exciting thing is yesterday I went out, is tradition on MLK Day, celebrated by watching prep basketball. That's always big around here. Historically, it's been the MLK Classic Tournament. That kind of has not been as prominent this year, and instead it was replaced. The big game was the Unity in the Community Tournament at Garfield High School, where Garfield played Franklin.
At Garfield, yeah. Not at Heck Ed.
No.
Interesting.
Garfield played Franklin for the first time in a couple of years.
They don't play each other every year?
No, because Garfield is, I think Garfield is 4A and Franklin is 3A.
Okay, they should play each other every year,
classifications. No matter what. They absolutely should. But the good news is next year, all the the Seattle teams are going to be in the same division again. They're all going to be 3A.
And so who stood out in that game?
Well, the most interesting prospect, Tremaine Isabel is a senior at Garfield who's headed to Wazoo, and he was the best player on the floor. Garfield ended up pulling away after trailing early. They went into a zone and just kind of got it going and dominated and took control at home. Franklin's best player and the best prospect, I think, possibly on the court is a kid named Keith Smith, who's a sophomore wing. He's 6'5", really long. He kind of is reminiscent of Gerald Green. I mean, obviously not that caliber of player, but he kind of plays a little bit like Gerald Green, where he jumps really high on his jumpers, has very long arms. It's a kind of a weird shooting motion. He was very talented, but he ended up fouling out early in the fourth quarter.
Was he a good shooter? He was a good shooter?
Okay.
He's a soft foul, was he?
Yeah, he's like 15 or 16.
Jesus Christ.
That's the weird thing. But big-time potential. Supposedly, Washington has already offered him. Lorenzo Romar was in the house to watch these games. Also, Mark Few. I saw Portland State's coach and then representatives from, I think, four or five other colleges.
What's
over there.
Portland State's coach name?
Tyler Geving.
Okay, great. It's weird that you didn't say that. You should have said Portland State coach Tyler Geving. I've never heard of him.
I don't know how many people would recognize that name. I don't think you're alone in not knowing
him. Just making sure you knew.
But the real treat was the first game. I mean, obviously Franklin Garfield's exciting, but Rainier Beach is, yeah, I believe, now up to number two in the country.
Oh, wow.
So they had gone and played in Springfield, Massachusetts at a Hoop Hall of Fame high school tournament over the weekend, and then flew back and got home Sunday night and then played in this game Monday afternoon.
Who
were
they playing?
In this game? They were playing O'Day.
Oh, wow.
And Beach is just stacked. Probably four or five D1 players. So the most notable of them is Shaquan Aaron, a senior, 6'8", really super long, athletic.
And he's going to Louisville?
He's headed to Louisville. He's following in the footsteps of Peyton Siva and former
Terrence Williams.
Beach star Terrence Williams. So Rick Pitino has a really nice inroads into Seattle, unfortunately, with guys that want to get away and go play in the ACC now. Was it formerly in the Big East, but so he's obviously very talented, but I was just blown away with David Crisp, who recently accepted a scholarship offer from UW, and he's a senior but is headed to prep school next year, so he won't show up on campus until 2015-16, but he's a lefty 6'1 point guard, kind of in the Isaiah Thomas, Nate Robinson.
Sounds really similar to Isaiah Thomas too, going to prep school for a year.
Yep, there's some definite similarities. A big time leaper like those guys are. Not as quick, not as good an athlete, but kind of well built and a very good leader, good outside shooter. He showed a floater, was able to finish. He was the best player on the court, in my opinion. So I'm really excited about his prospects at UW, assuming that he's able to get his academics order and stays committed.
And there's no chance of him coming to UW next year?
Not that I know of. And they're still recruiting a couple of other guys. Beach has two other big prospects.
I think it's really exciting having somebody coming from Seattle. We talked about this a few weeks ago on the podcast, but having a really good player from Seattle on the Huskies, I think, is really important. And I think it's really important for Lorenzo to continue to establish Seattle, right? So if Rick Pitino has inroads into Seattle, that's kind of an unfortunate thing, and you would want Lorenzo and UW to basically blanket everybody who's playing here. It's a harder thing to do in basketball as opposed to something like football, where you can offer tons of guys. In basketball, the players are able to look at and see, like, okay, I'm going to be able to get playing time here and here and here. But getting one of the best players from Seattle is so important for the UW program.
Well, you want to put a fence around the state. That's the ideal. Now, there's always guys...
Honestly, and that's what I was saying, the fence around the state concept makes more sense in football because no matter what position you play, if you're at the school for 3 years, if you're good, you're going to play.
And the other thing is, you can take more guys. So, for example, last year UW had a choice between Nigel Williams-Goss, who is probably going to play 3 or 4 years in college, or Zach Levine, who might be one and done at UCLA. Mm-hmm. So he's had a really great freshman season at UCLA, but I still think I'd rather have Nigel Williams-Goss for the next, X number of years. But you can only have one of those two guys. That's the difference in basketball than in football, except for maybe quarterbacks. But the other thing is, there's some guys that just, they need to get away or want to get away. Like Peyton Siva had some issues at home. It was important for him to be out of Seattle. And so UW never really had a great chance at him. And that's just kind of happened sometimes. But It is big to get, you know, there's not a local product on the roster right now. And I think that's part of why fans are not as excited about Husky basketball and as they were when its homegrown
it's
starts.
It's absolutely something that the Huskies need to reestablish. And so you're thinking that Chris might be somebody who can kind of restart the program.
I mean, I don't want to go that far, but I think he could inject a boost. And
how electric was it in the gym when he was playing?
It wasn't as electric an atmosphere as Franklin Garfield. So more people were waiting for that because it was the home game and the big rivalry and everything. But I mean, you know, Beach is just so preposterously talented that even being fatigued from this cross country trip, they just kind of had their way with O'Day in the second half.
Who else is on that team besides the two D1 players that you mentioned?
Well, they've got two other guys. DeJounte Murray is I think he's a junior, who's. And then they've got DeJuan Piper, who's a senior who's probably headed the JC route. Both those guys have offers from UW and other Pac-12 teams and are that caliber of player.
So it could be three Beach players coming to UW eventually.
Potentially. It could be like 2014, 2015, 2000, or I guess it would be two in 2015, one in 2016.
I mean, it's unfortunate that they have to wait so long to get these guys.
Yeah, and they do have a relatively local guy, Donovan Dorsey, from Timberline in Olympia, in Lacey, who's headed up here next year.
Pretty deep far south, though. It's another type of situation where you have guys from Seattle, where people in the community, a lot of people know them, a lot of people have relationships with them, and the amount that you just have fans cheering for them is way, way different versus somebody from Timberline who went, Jonathan Stewart went there and went to Oregon. We said that they were basically in Oregon.
Which is not true, but Donovan Dorsey just hurt his ankle and got good news today that it's merely a sprain. It thought it might be a fracture that would have ended his senior year.
Well, this is some positive news. It makes us not have to talk about Husky basketball for a week to talk about future Husky basketball.
At this point, it's probably a little bit more exciting, frankly.
And then I have to mention that we're drinking this, speaking of not Husky basketball, speaking of basically an Oregon. This Rogue Honey Orange Wheat Beer, Honey Orange Wheat Ale, it's really good.
It is. I thought that would be good, and I was correct.
I had a donut beforehand, so my palate was a little bit strange.
I mean, but that was local Top Pot Donuts.
It was. But we've had, over the span of 2 months, three or four different Rogue beers, and this is my favorite.
I would agree with
this
that.
This kills Beard Beer.
Yes, it is much better.
I would much rather drink Honey Orange Wheat Ale than Beard Beer, but I think it's also better than the Portland State IPA also.
Yeah, I would agree.
The Portland State Pale Ale, and what were some of the other ones that we drank?
We drank Santa's
Little Helper. Oh, Santa's Private Reserve Ale.
Santa's Private.
This is the best and the last of...
And Yellow Snow.
Oh, and Yellow Snow IPA. That was pretty good.
No.
You didn't like that?
We thought it tasted too much like Yellow Snow.
Oh, well.
That's how I thought.
The Rogue beers are very authentic.
They are.
If it says Beard Beer, it's Beard Beer.
It's truth in advertising.
If it's Santa's Private Reserve, it's going to be Santa's Private Reserve.
But that's the beauty of Rogue, is they give you so many different things to try. And you're eventually bound to find something you love.
But I think this is really good. I hope that Rogue is able to play. Maybe I hope that we don't know too well to play into our future all-beer podcast.
Yeah, I mean, that's dangerous. It could be like when they used to have the Pepsi Challenge at the Hydro races, and we could guess which one is which because we played it so many times.
We're not going to do a blind taste test of the beers.
Oh, okay.
We're not going to be choosing between them.
Oh.
To win a hat or something.
I thought that might be better. Maybe I discover I really do like the Lucille IPA if I didn't know there was Lucille IPA.
Oh, man, that's interesting. I'm excited for that. And then I think we have to wrap things up really quick by... We're not going to do a Vic Ballard-Jermaine Kearse comparison, but say that Jermaine Kearse, the fabulous Pelton Cast sponsored player on Pro Football Reference, with the touchdown in the NFC Championship game, when we decided to sponsor his page, I said... We'll get a lot of action when he scores a touchdown in the Super Bowl. And now this whole scenario is set up.
It's really coming together.
So I'm really hoping that Jermaine Kearse in 2 weeks scores. I mean, I hope anybody scores a touchdown.
That's true. Let's start with someone.
But for you have your three different things, like we were excited about during the season. You clinch the playoffs, clinch your division, clinch home field, clinch the number one seed.
Yeah.
Jermaine Kearse, score a touchdown. Jermaine Kearse scores a touchdown. First, let's go with
score points. Score a touchdown. Jermaine Kearse scores a touchdown.
So that'll be very exciting. And a lot more people will have heard of Jermaine Kearse. I was talking to our mom last night, and I was like, have you heard of this player? Have you heard of this? Because she's a big Seahawks fan. I air-quoted that.
That's the sign that the Seahawks have taken over casual fans.
And I was like, have you heard of Jermaine Kearse? And she was like, I vaguely know his name. I hadn't heard of him before the game on Sunday. I was like, oh, yeah, he's from Tacoma and went to UW.
I think it's really the national media that has taken note of Jermaine Kearse.
But
it's part of the pedestrian receiving corps, as they so proudly pointed out afterwards.
But the scenario is set for Jermaine Kearse. I mean, he is the deep threat on the team right now. Or Jermaine Kearse to score a touchdown in the Super Bowl.
Our cousin would really have the last laugh on us if that happens.
I guess so. Maybe versus Vic Ballard.
Vic Ballard definitely will not be scoring a touchdown.
These are not,
in the
these
Super Bowl.
Don't count for fantasy points.
That's true.
Jermaine Kearse scoring a touchdown. We'll be back with a thorough Pro Bowl recap next week and nothing else.
Can't wait.
Thank you.